Hello, and welcome to the August issue of the Royal Society podcast, Our Science. I'm Matt Allinson.
And I'm Ben Cunningham.
This month we'll be talking summer holidays with science, and meeting some of the new fellows of the Royal Society. But first up, we're talking about science and the Sendai framework.
Natural disasters such as floods, earthquakes, droughts and heatwaves can have devastating impacts on vulnerable people around the world. Climate change and a growing global population mean that people are becoming more and more vulnerable to the impacts of disasters. But the new Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction, adopted by UN countries in March, aims to reduce disaster risk by calling on scientists to work with governments and communities. We spoke to Margareta Wahlström, the UN Special Representative to the Secretary General on Disaster Risk Reduction, Tom Mitchell, the Head of Climate Change at the Overseas Development Institute, and Robert Muirwood, Chief Research Officer at Risk Management Solutions, who were attending a two-day meeting of experts on disaster risk here at the Royal Society in June to find out more about how science can help to protect people from disasters around the world.
I'm Margareta Wahlström. I'm the Special Representative of the Secretary General of United Nations for Disaster Risk Reduction. And I have been doing this particular task now for the past 6.5 years.
Hi, my name's Tom Mitchell. I work as Head of Climate Change at the Overseas Development Institute, a think tank here in the UK. We have a group that works on disaster risk reduction. We particularly advise developing country governments who are suffering from high levels of disaster risk on how best to tackle that risk.
My name is Robert Muirwood. I'm the Chief Research Officer at a risk modelling company. So we develop models for catastrophe risk all around the world, principally for the insurance industry.
Well, the United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction and the International Strategy for Disaster Risk Reduction is actually something that the UN's General Assembly has established in order to work not actually with disasters, but with the risks that generate disasters.
The Sendai Framework was signed in March by 185 governments. It's a global agreement to tackle disasters around the world and to really do so ahead of time. So rather than waiting for the disaster to hit and then responding to it, and that costs a lot of money, kills a lot of people, damages a lot of people's livelihoods, we're trying to move that upstream and say, what can we do to prevent disasters? And this agreement sets out a roadmap for trying to prevent disasters across the world.
The Sendai Framework is the product of an engagement with thousands of people, government, local government, community, specialists, science, persons living with disability, old people, young people, women, kids, you name it. And approximately 2-3 years ago, we asked them, what have been the big challenges for you in implementing the intention of the previous framework, which was called Yoga Framework for Action? So the product is, in fact, the Sendai Framework for Action. And it's got some very important, innovative new aspects that will assist us all in implementation. It is an intergovernmental instrument and therefore goes into the body of agreement that governments take very seriously.
It's easier to actually get governments to set up institutions or to try and take action at a big scale, but actually trying to get change on the ground, trying to get builders to actually use the building codes, trying to ensure that people really avoid living in the flood zones. It's a matter of actually really comprehending the way that risk is actually generated. A lot of activities at present, for example, around development, have the property of creating risk as fast as we are trying to get on top of reducing it. I think that is the challenge. I think that it's translating the science to its application, to its real application with the people on the ground, I think is the biggest challenge.
The first challenge was to get the framework, and now we have it. So the implementation is to now get extremely practical. We got 15 years. And the framework includes a set of global targets. Next year, through an intergovernmental process, there will be agreement on the indicators for these global targets. And then countries need to set their own targets that will help to contribute to these global targets. And the global targets are very ambitious. For example, the reduction of mortality, reduction of number of affected persons, and the reduction of the impact of economic losses to the global GDP. So these are ambitious goals, and it will require cooperation among countries, but also all of us in support of countries.
Well, at the moment, we see around many countries that the capacity that they have in governments or at the local level to really tackle disaster risk is very limited, and particularly across countries in Africa and Asia that suffer the worst of the losses. Let me just give you an example for it. You know, the Nepal earthquake happened just 2 months ago now, and the housing stock, the buildings, the schools, the roads were not built to a standard that could withstand that kind of shaking. And it's, you know, the development process, the support to countries and countries' own decisions really need to be at an improved level to ensure that the infrastructure, the cities that we have, can withstand that kind of impact. So we've been meeting for the last 2 days to talk about the way in which science and technology can help support governments and businesses in dealing with disaster risk. And that's a big challenge, because we need to look to the future, foresee the future, think about what kind of disasters may hit, and then convey the nature of that risk, the nature of those potential impacts, to all the people who need to take action. And the meeting over the last 2 days has started to think about the ways in which we can collaborate globally to offer the best possible advice to governments. So science organisations, who are actually very good at understanding these kind of challenges, need to talk more with each other and talk more with governments to give that best possible advice.
Today and yesterday we've been discussing around the science, but really it's all about the application. I mean, there are some gaps in the science itself, but the most important gap is actually the delivery of information to change how people face disasters from a cultural perspective. And I think that all the time we are talking about building bridges between the science itself and its application. I think we have a long way to go. I think we've been discussing measures, systems, partnering, centres of excellence, but this has to be the focus going forward.
The Royal Society has kindly hosted us now a number of times, and it is a very engaged and supportive science community. They help to get science very strongly into the Sendai framework. In fact, the Sendai framework asks science to be involved in almost everything in order to help to establish methodologies, data issues, identify different courses of action, just be an important partner in this enterprise. Today we've had a very interesting discussion about, now we have the Sendai framework, what are the priorities from a scientific point of view, and where are the competences, and above all, how do we live up to the call in the framework and in reality, that science also need to contribute to help to build scientific and research capacity in countries that have very low capacity. So it's not just science doing science in their own domestic environment. It's also think about the opportunity and responsibility for building capacity in many countries that have very low level of science capacity. That's what I hope will happen in the next 15 years.
Last month, the Royal Society welcomed 59 new fellows, honorary fellows, and foreign members. As part of the celebrations, a seminar is hosted, where each new fellow presents a short talk, and we were lucky enough to speak to a number of them about their work. We spoke to Professor A.J. Kumar Sood from the Indian Institute of Science, whose work looks to try and understand the natural phenomenon of flocking, as seen in birds, locusts and fish, with physics.
I'm A.J. Sood. I'm a professor of physics at Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore, that is south of India. And I'm a condensed matter experimental physicist. Yeah, so today I talked about a very ubiquitous phenomenon of flocking, which you see all around us in birds, fishes, bacteria. So I told what is a physicist's take on that? How, as a physicist, how can we get a minimal understanding of this very complex emergent phenomena? Emergent means the individual entities decide what they want to do. There is no central coordination. So we work with inanimate active granular medium, and we had some fun to show that when we increase their number beyond a certain point and we have an intervening medium, these polar particles or active particles start moving collectively, which is what you see in some ant mill or locusts and so on. And so we are trying to understand natural phenomena in a physics lab and get a understanding of that.
How's that sort of that understanding of physics, then how do you then apply that to sort of what happens in biology?
So the point is, you have to see what is the, why do they flock? So the it is known that, you know, if one they are moving, then the neighbors if influence the motion of the individual one. They look left, right, front, back, and get aligned. So this is all, you know, the neighbors interaction. Question is, if they feel somebody away, can they still interact? So we showed that it is possible. It need not be just the neighbor. It can be next nearest neighbor, it can be next to next nearest neighbor. So that kind of a feeling people didn't know that it is possible. And we think our experiments throw that possibility into the arena.
What does it mean to you to become a fellow of the society?
Yeah, it's a great feeling actually, because Royal Society, you know, is at the apex of scientific recognition. So, the entire work which I have done in my life is done in India. So it means even more that you are among the peers which are regarded something. This thing. So you get a good feeling, and I think it's an extremely valuable recognition, and it eggs us on to do better.
We also spoke to Professor Philip Donoghue on the significance of being elected a Fellow of the Society and his research on molecular paleobiology at the University of Bristol.
My name is Phil Donoghue and I'm from the University of Bristol.
Can you tell us a bit more about your research?
I work on fossils mainly. I'm a paleontologist. I also try to integrate evidence from the fossil record with molecular biology to understand evolutionary history.
So in your talk you mentioned molecular clocks. What are they?
Molecular clocks are a way of telling evolutionary time. It's a way of establishing an evolutionary time scale for the tree of life to work out when certain groups of organisms evolved in relation to other events in Earth history, like climate change and so on. And the way they work is by taking an evolutionary tree based on genetic data, molecular sequence data, and trying to calibrate that to time using fossil evidence. So if we know that a certain evolutionary lineage, like humans, fossils that date back, say, 2 or 3 million years, we can use that as a minimum constraint on the number of mutations that have been acquired within the human lineage, and work out the evolutionary rate, which we can then use to date other parts of the tree.
In your talk, you were looking at vertebrates with jaws. Is this the only one area that you can look at in terms of paleobiology?
So it's all animals with backbones are vertebrates, and a subset of them have jaws. Actually, most of the living ones have jaws. So I was talking about how their body pan, which is more than just a pretty smile of jaws with teeth, it's about the origin of paired appendages, our arms and legs, and the origin of aspects of our skeleton and so on. But I also work on the origin of animals, the origin of plants as well, and I also work on the evolution of proteins and microRNAs. So I combine work on fossils with trying to understand molecular evolution as well.
What does it mean to you to be awarded a fellowship or to become a fellow of the Royal Society?
Well, it's completely flabbergasting, really. I must say, nobody was more surprised than me, really, when I was awarded it. And I still haven't quite got over the shock. So the significance of it to me is, you know, I've looked up to people all my career who've been awarded it, and I've been given the same honour, and maybe in a few years' time I'll get used to it, but it'll take a while.
Professor Yvonne Ellsworth is Professor of Helioseismology at the University of Birmingham. Professor Ellsworth explains much better than us what a professor of helioseismology is and discusses what the sun would sound like if it was in an orchestra.
I'm Yvonne Ellsworth. I'm a professor of, well, fancy title is Helios Seismology, but it's a topic within astronomy in the University of Birmingham.
So your work is looking at helioseismology, which is looking at, I guess, eruptions in the sun or movements of the plasma within the sun. Could you just explain what it is?
Well, in a sense, you're right, but your presentation is slightly more extreme than the reality. What we have is gentle bulk motion of the whole sun about its centre. It gently vibrates, not always symmetrically. Sometimes it's the straight breathing in-out, but there's a huge diversity of shapes of oscillations that are possible. The periodicity is about 5 minutes, so it's not an eruption that happens quickly. It's a gentle in-out, in-out. And the amount of movement, the sort of meters, is actually rather small.
What can you tell about the inside of a star like the Sun from looking at its surface or this slow periodicity that you've just described?
Okay, if you just look at the surface, you have to build a theory, right? If you look at these slow oscillations, if there were just one of them, then you could tell how long it took sound to cross the object, the Sun, and from that you get a guess at its mean density. But because there isn't just one oscillation, but are hundreds, thousands of them, and each one of them is sensitive to a slightly different part of the volume of the sun, then from that you can build up a picture of essentially the speed of sound in the interior. And if you add a bit of physics to that, you can discover all sorts of things about the processes.
You obviously, you're working here in effectively in sound, but you're kind of almost seeing sound. What would it sound like if we actually heard the sun, the inside of the sun?
Okay, the first thing to say is you're absolutely correct. I'm not hearing the sun. I'm seeing the sound waves. Okay. You can't hear 5 minutes, right? It's too slow for you. So what people do is speed up the sound to produce frequencies in the audible range. And there are several websites around, including the one run by my group, the Bison Group, which will let you hear this. But sadly, it sounds like noise because there are so many frequencies present, you don't get a single sound out of it. However, if you want to hear things like this, there are stars that pulsate with a small number of frequencies, classical pulsators, and there are people who've built music, synthesized music, as to what a horn would sound like if it had just the few oscillations from these. And they are beautiful, haunting music, but the sun just sounds noisy.
If the sun was an instrument in an orchestra that was built up out of all of the stars, what instrument would it be, do you think?
Okay, right. Well, the first criterion here for solar-like oscillators is that you need convection and any turbulence in the outer layer. So that limits you when a star is in its normal long-lived phase on the so-called main sequence. That limits you to stars that are similar in size to the Sun. As the Sun gets older and ages, it gets bigger. So from being, if we said it just had one note, which it doesn't, from being sort of an ordinary trumpet type thing, then as you head out to these giant stars, you'll be heading into the double bass and huge. I mean, maybe we're into whales in the deep ocean or something. That's something that's really, really big. So as the stars get bigger, the oscillation frequencies get lower and lower and lower.
I like the idea of the sun sounding like a blue whale in the ocean. In our next interview from the New Fellows seminar, we speak to Professor Andrew Knoll, who is a world leader in the study of evolution of life on Earth. We spoke to him about the Cambrian explosion, which happened 542 million years ago. This resulted in major diversification of organisms, which can clearly be seen in the Earth's fossil record.
My name is Andy Knoll. I'm a paleontologist, and broadly speaking, I'd like to understand the history of Earth and life that has given rise to the climate, the biodiversity that we see today. And really all my work is motivated by a single observation that's fascinated me since I was a boy, and that is that we live on a planet that records its own history, and that history is recorded largely in the physical, chemical, and biological features of sedimentary rocks.
One of the things that your work concentrates on is the idea that leading up to the Cambrian explosion, which is, this was a big explosion in the types of life that there were, you work on carnivorous, the carnivory of these species. Do you want to just elaborate on that?
Yes, well, the observation that's been known really since before the time of Darwin is that the fossil record of animals, at least animals that are familiar to us, goes back to the Cambrian period, and that means the last 541 million years. And at that point, for the first time, we see a diversity and complexity of animal body plans in the ocean. And one of the things that our group has been interested in is, why do we see this event when and where we do? Because it is set in the context of a deeper evolutionary history that actually extends back 3 billion years before that. One of the things that we've looked at specifically was the relationship between oxygen and the various lifestyles that animals can have. And largely through the insights of a very bright member of my lab named Eric Sperling, we found that if you look at ecological surveys of parts of the ocean today that have very little oxygen, you find that while animals are present at very, very low oxygen abundances, now they may be animals that are 100 microns long and 20 microns wide, but animals are present. One specific type of animal that we don't see until oxygen levels increase substantially is carnivores, animals that eat other animals. And that becomes interesting for two reasons that are intertwined. First is that for many years, people have suggested that the advent of carnivory was an ecological driver for early animal diversification. And second is that geochemical evidence suggests that this was also a time of oxygen increase in the atmosphere and oceans. So what this work suggests is that it isn't a question of was there an ecological driver or an environmental driver, but rather that in carnivory we see that ecology and environment are two sides of the same coin.
If the chemistry of the Earth changes dramatically in the future, could something else happen? Could there be a new stage of life?
Well, that's a good question, and the one thing that most of us would say about evolution is it's not deeply predictive. That is, I'm not sure that had members of the Royal Society have been standing around watching life 800 million years ago that they would have predicted dinosaurs or trilobites, and they would have been ridiculed had they predicted them. So we don't really know. I think in the long term, are there as yet unforeseen evolutionary possibilities? I suspect the answer is yes in some general sense. But I think when most of us think about environmental change, we're thinking about environmental change over the next century or two. And there, I think there is something approaching consensus among scientists that the changes, the biological responses, will be largely negative.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So Robin Saxby is one of our new honorary fellows. He's a technology entrepreneur and founded Arm Holdings, which supplies microprocessors for mobile phones and became the most successful processor company in the world. We spoke to him about how to get involved in the sector and enjoying life off the clock.
Do you have any advice for young graduates who are wanting to get involved in the technology business?
So I think there are two things. So one of the things, so I work for Rank Bush Murphy for 4 years, Pi TMC for a year, Henderson for 2 years, Motorola for 11 years. And Motorola is a big corporation. So I didn't get involved in the startup world until I was quite old. But I'd learnt every mistake I could from working from all those other companies. So I actually feel, again, the problems I had at Henderson and the style of their management actually helped me with some of the shareholder conflicts we had with OMP. So we learn from our experience. So what I'm saying is nothing beats experience, and certainly as a young graduate working for a larger corporation who will pay for your training, you know, I went on lots of management courses, I certainly think that helped me. That's one way of doing it. I think the other way of doing it is somebody who is a true entrepreneur already at a young age, and you know, we'd put Michael Dell in that category, or Bill Gates, I suppose. If you're that sort of personality, my advice would be find a few friends and do it together. And so, because I think doing it on your own is impossible. So I think you need to look at, you know, again in life, we all want different things out of life. So the other thing I would say is, as well as worrying about this business, before you even get there, work out what you want in life, because that is actually a higher level priority than the business. And you can, you know, you can drive yourself to death literally working too hard or not working hard enough or getting depressed or whatever. So I do believe in setting some life goals first, working out what you would want to do. I mean, the thing I would say is, this is something I actually did in Motorola. This is one of the management things we do with Motorola. In one of the workshops, I wrote down on a piece of paper, we were asked, where do you want to be in 30 years' time? And I wrote it all down. And then, how do you get there? And I wrote all that down. And that's kind of what I've done, actually.
You've achieved it.
Yeah.
So what are your current life goals?
So my current life goals are actually to have the latter part of my life as exciting and as much fun and as, in inverted commas, healthily as my previous goal. What I do think has changed, and this is something I realised, in my working life with Arm, I did 2 long-haul flights every month. And I'm still married to the same girl that I met in Liverpool a very long time ago, who got me to be a Liverpool supporter. That's an important note. We hope we'll have a better season this year. And what I've realised is that, and she was a school teacher and she was bringing the kids up. So now I've retired from Arm, I'm spending more time with my wife. We're doing more things together, and the way one works with one's wife and daughter, because by the way, I've done a project on alternative energy with my wife and daughter, and my son says, "You're mad, Dad, you don't want to do that." Well, we've done it and it's successful. We've turned an 1831 house to be a lot more energy efficient, and that's very exciting as well. So in this phase of my life, it's about having as much fun and as making as big a difference in a different environment, and that's quite challenging, by the way, just so you know. Oh, the other thing is, as I'm a big skier, I have a goal to ski one more day per year until I die. All the startups have to come skiing with me. And this year, you'll be pleased to hear, I've done 79 days. I hit my target, so I have to have targets. So it's about, and what I realise is, looking forwards to the rest of our lives, you know, we're all born the same way. We all go out the same way. It's a journey. It's about making the most of every day. And there are things I can do now which I couldn't do, so I can do more skiing. I'm actually going to the Henley Festival tonight on my boat to listen to Lionel Richie. So I've got more relaxed time. But I think the biggest 2 things that I think I can do something about, and we're doing something about, is try and maintain our bodies in healthily shaped. So we, and this is another message where science comes in. I think the, you know, if you look at most bodies today, they're too big. They're being poisoned by the food industry, and there's something we can do about that. So that's something I'm very interested in. I'm also very interested in the application of technology to that. And so I would say to every human being, if you stop and think and listen to what your brain is telling you, you can do whatever you want.
Professor Anne Cutler is another of our newly elected fellows and is research professor at the Marx Institute at the University of Western Sydney and emeritus director of the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics in Neumagen. We caught up with her to find out a bit about psycholinguistics and what poetry can teach us about language processing.
Well, the basic premise of psycholinguistics is that the processing mechanisms that underlie our use of language are the same for everybody, because a baby isn't born to speak, acquire the language of its parents. You can take a baby that has English-speaking parents and take it just after birth to China and give it to some Chinese family, and the baby will grow up, of course, speaking perfect Chinese. And the baby will always acquire the language of the environment that is presented to it early on. And that means, of course, that the underlying processing mechanisms are not in any way genetically determined by linguistic factors that in any way involved with the inheritance that the baby has from its parents. That was taken in the early years of psycholinguistics to mean that, okay, whatever we work on in the psycholinguistic laboratory, we're dealing with universal processing mechanisms. So they're going to be the same whatever language we're speaking. So in the early years of psycholinguistics, and this was actually when I came into the field in the 1970s, it was still perfectly normal to do an experiment in one lab, and then somebody in another lab would say, well, you know, I have a different interpretation of that experiment. I think their interpretation is wrong. I'll do my experiment and test it. And, hey, look, I got a different result, so I'll publish it. And do that without ever mentioning that the first and the second experiment were done in different countries, which spoke different languages. So there were experiments on syntax that compared processing of English with processing of Spanish and got completely different results, and people were arguing a lot about that. There were experiments on segmenting speech in English and in French that got completely different results. And this is actually where I came in, because there was a experiment in French which showed that the syllable was an extremely important unit in processing French and listening to French. It was a segmentation unit, so you would segment the incoming speech signal syllable by syllable, and as soon as I heard that, I knew this cannot possibly work for English, you know, and indeed in English I had results showing that stress groups were very important. And then, you know, you think, actually, there is a universal there, because if you look at poetry, the rhythm that you always find in poetry is different in poetry in different languages. And in English, of course, our poetic rhythm is stress-based. So we have poetic forms like the limerick, for instance. A limerick's rhythm is best with the strongest of syllables stressed, and so on. But in French, if you look in the books about French poetry, it's actually syllable-based, the rhythm of French. And that is, in fact, true. There is a difference in rhythm. And so we did a lot of experiments comparing this and found out that, in fact, the syllable-based perception that French people had of their language wasn't due to the input. It wasn't the input that was driving that. It was in their head, because they did exactly the same thing when presented with English input, and they tried to segment that syllable by syllable and got completely different results with the English materials that we gave them. When we gave English people the French syllable, the French materials, which had produced a beautifully syllabic response from the French listeners, they didn't do that at all. They just gave us a kind of flat line, which is what you get from presenting the same things in English to English-speaking listeners. In other words, that meant that the processing that was going on was different in the French people's heads and the English people's heads. So it wasn't the language input that was driving processing. The processing mechanisms had been changed, which must have happened, of course, between birth and adulthood. So in other words, the processing mechanisms that you apply in listening to speech are tailored by your native language to suit that native language. Well, the segmentation story, and this was back in the 1980s, was just the beginning, and that completely revolutionized this area of psycholinguistics, because then you could start, hey, maybe there are other aspects of listening to speech that are tailored to the native language, and that turned out to be true across the board.
It was a pretty busy couple of days, with over 50 talks covering a whole range of subjects. As it's August, and some of you might be listening to this on your summer holidays, we thought we would also ask the new fellows what they were planning on doing on their summer holidays. They had some pretty exciting things planned, and managed to include science too.
Okay, well, I have had a holiday this year, and I went north. In other words, we went to Scandinavia and had a wonderful time across essentially Stockholm, Oslo, and across to Bergen, and then up the Norwegian fjords. I had never been to the Arctic, albeit low Arctic, and it was amazing. As an astronomer, one of the things that was, or two things were amazing. First of all, how long it takes the sun to set. You get sunsets that just go on forever. But I had thought, okay, I'm heading north. It's not the time of the continuous summer. But I expected sunset to get later and later and later. And when I looked it up before I went, that wasn't true. What was true is that I was moving east all the time, so that sunrise was getting earlier and earlier and earlier. And we got across to longitudes of something like Cairo. That was just amazing to see the geometry of the lines of longitude being so close together that with a couple of days' travel, you were travelling so far. So that was really neat.
Well, I'm planning to do some research. The students have gone away, so I've got a bit of free time over the summer to catch up on research projects and maybe even get to the bench and do some of my own research rather than just supervising and directing other people's research. But I'm also looking forward to just spending time with the kids. And although I'm a geologist and I study rocks, it'll be fun just to run up hills and down them with the kids as well.
Largely because of this wonderful opportunity to join the Royal Society, my family has joined me in London. And after we leave London, we have a little bit of, I guess, a busman's holiday in that we're going to go down to the Dorset Coast. And actually, I'm going to look at some fossils.
The Jurassic Coast is a wonderful place to go.
It's beautiful. It's spectacular.